Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Pocket Theology. I am here with my buddy Martin to talk about naturalism. If that doesn't sound interesting to you, trust me, it is relevant to your life because whether or not you know it, almost everyone you know thinks this way. We are going to give you insights into the human mind. That should sound a little more interesting to you. So stick around today. We hope that this is helpful. Martin, please greet the people.
Shalom, y'all.
Shalom, y'all. From Southern Israel, Martin Hinton. That was terrific. That's so much better than just saying shalom. Shalom, y'all. Golly. All right. So those cattle down in Jerusalem are doing well, Martin. Besides that, how you doing over there?
We're doing good. Keeping busy. Jason is dropping utensils.
I am. I was twirling a spoon and just dropped it on my desk. That was great. Oh, I'll just leave all that in there.
You should.
All right, man. Well, today we are continuing our little mini series about worldview. And worldview sounds, when we first mention it to people, people are like, oh, that doesn't matter. It's just philosophy. And here's the thing. Philosophy matters. Worldview matters because everything that you do in life is based off of a series of unspoken assumptions. Let me make that plain English for our listeners. If I decide that it is important for me, for example, to take care of my body and exercise, which I do think, there's a ton of assumptions I'm making in order to decide to be semi-healthy. Like, for example, I'm making the assumption that life is worth living and I would like to have more years on this planet. So there's these unspoken assumptions behind every decision that I make. If I get married, there's unspoken assumptions I make about the importance of having a romantic partner and of living a life with one person for my entire life or of having children or whatever. So every behavior that you have is rooted, whether or not you choose to admit it, in a series of assumptions. Philosophical assumptions we call a worldview. If you believe in a God, you'll probably behave differently than someone who doesn't, at least in certain areas of your life. So that's why I think it's really important for Christians to realize where their worldview has been influenced by things besides the scriptures, besides church tradition. So we're talking today about what we think is the default worldview of most people, including people inside the church, whether or not they realize it. And it's a worldview called naturalism. Can you define naturalism for us?
I sure can. This is something that not only Jason and I think is the default worldview, but a lot of really important and really smart people like Natasha Crane in her book Faithfully Different, who believes that this is the default worldview of the West. And so this isn't just something that we made up and said, this is what we think. This is socially accepted as the norm. And like Jason said, it even pervades into the church all of the time. And we can talk about that a little bit as well when we get into it. But naturalism is the worldview that the only things that exist are the things that you can see and touch, the natural world, right? And there's a pretty significant problem with that in Christianity. And the really, like, obvious one is a lot of Christianity doesn't have to do with what you can see and touch, right? So naturalism might accept that Jesus existed as a person in around AD 30, right? But naturalism would not be able to accept that Jesus is God, because in order for us to understand God, we have to understand spirits and what makes Jesus different than us. And so a naturalist worldview doesn't account for spirits or souls. It doesn't account for miracles, and it doesn't account for deities, because you cannot physically touch or see any of those things, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and the key here is naturalism only admits to the physical. It only admits to, as Martin said, things that you can see and touch or hear and taste, or that can be in some sense observed. So for example, like I cannot, like just because I am too large and they are too small, I cannot touch a quark. a subatomic particle, the thing that makes up protons and neutrons. I can't touch them, but we can test, we can verify their physical existence. Even though they behave really strangely and there's a lot of things we don't know about them, we can verify that they exist by testing and measuring them. So we are capable of doing that. Naturalism only admits to forces and things that are in some sense observable, things we can touch, taste, hear, or test or measure or verify exist physically. That means there is no such thing in naturalism as a soul. There is no such thing as a god or an angel or a demon. And when we say that naturalism is the default worldview of the West, we don't mean that most people in the West don't believe in something supernatural. What we mean is the way they behave. We made this delineation in our last episode. The way people behave, they behave as though they're naturalists. They behave as though there's no such thing as a supernatural world. Even though if you ask them, hey, do you think that there are spiritual beings or angels or demons or gods or whatever, they might tell you yes, but they don't act like it.
And most of the time when they say yes, they'll tell you a story about seeing or experiencing that. And so they can fit it into their worldview.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good observation that even a lot of people will call themselves, whether they call themselves Christians or just say, like, I'm spiritual, but not religious. It'll be a story of a experienced reality that they or someone close to them or someone they deem believable has had. And I think it's part of the reason why like charismatic movements are popular, because people want to see and experience. And I think that's really good in some ways, but in some ways it's dangerous when your expectation is that this transcendent invisible God I worship has to reveal himself to me personally. And I can't trust the scriptures or the tradition of the church or the testimony of others to be good enough. That can be dangerous. Maybe that's a podcast for another time though. So naturalism is based around things that can be seen, tested, tasted, experienced, whatever. Physical realities we can verify, and nothing else exists. So how did this become the default worldview in the West, Martin? What made this so popular that unless your community specifically pushes back against it, you probably have at least some aspect of this worldview in your background?
So there's a couple of people have ideas. The one that I subscribe to is the continuation, the development of science. And so I don't think that's a bad thing, by the way. I love the fact that science has come so far, because 200 years ago, Jason and I would not be able to talk to each other at all.
And I'm a thick boy. I need my air conditioning. Like, thank you, science, for air conditioning and insulation. No kidding. But die in the summer in Southern Illinois without it.
That's fair. But also, last week, I was super sick because I donate plasma twice a week, which is my white blood cells. That makes my immune system really weak. The fact that there is soap and hand sanitizer and things that can help me to avoid that pretty frequently is phenomenal to me. I mean, those are the kinds of things that we're talking about. Like, yes, there are observations that are made, but really the application of science has been awesome. And you will never hear me say that science should just stop sciencing.
And even when science doesn't give us something physical, so we're talking about like we can talk to each other and we have air conditioning and we have soap and we have medicine, like that's wonderful. But also like the aspects of science that delve into like how the world came to be, I think is wonderful. And we've talked a little bit before about like evolution versus like, you know, creationist views and how like Christians can definitely believe in the Big Bang and believe in evolution and all those things. Because we hold that point of view, we very deeply believe that like people who are, say, like theoretical physicists that really love delving into like the science of how the world was created, that can be a means of worship to say, wow, it's amazing that God was able to work these things together to create the world in such a magnificent and powerful and hard to understand way. That can be an aspect of worship. So that itself is very, very good, even if it doesn't give us practical tools we can put in our hands or attach to our homes or whatever. that's still a good thing. So we are a very pro-science podcast here.
Exactly. But as I was doing some studying for a paper that I wrote last semester on the rise of liberalism in the United States, I mean, all of it points towards Darwin and that time period when science really became a driving force in how we understand the world. And so part of the reason that liberalism became, you know, really popular in the time period it did is because the things that you could see and observe did not necessarily line up with what scripture taught in places. And that was one of the things that Christians struggled with a lot in that time period, and still do. We still do, honestly. But I think that that's probably where it starts. And here's how that chain works, right? So there becomes a new, reasonable, and tested, in air quotes, explanation for how things work. And so prior to that, the leading way that people understood the world was through what they believed about religion. And so, and most of it was cultural. Some of it changed, of course, because Christians for centuries prior to this had been sharing the gospel and converting people to Christianity. But all religions, I shouldn't say all religions, because I can't actually check that, but most religions have a creation myth that they subscribe to, and that's it teaches very specific things about the world. I think it was the Bible Project that does a video on creation and explains different parts of what the creation myth teaches us, and a lot of it's completely different in the Christian worldview than others. And so while
we've also mentioned this in past podcasts as well, so if you want more, go back through our catalog, go to the Bible Project or go to Pillar Podcast from Pillar Seminary. All three of those are going to have good resources for you.
Exactly. And so there are parts of Genesis 1 through 11 that teach us how to understand the world. And I always teach that that's the lens that God wants you to see the rest of the Bible through. And that's why Genesis 1 through 11 is so important, because it answers very specific worldview questions. Are people good? Why don't they all act that way? Right? Well, we know that people.
What is God like? What makes God angry?
Yeah. God takes the time to explain what our worldview looks like. And that is how we're supposed to see the world. And that's how people see the world for generations to come. And so now, all of a sudden, there's this new convincing worldview that doesn't, you know, it makes more sense because it's things that you can see and test for, like Jason said.
Yeah. Worldviews are necessarily tied into the zeitgeist of the culture that produces them. So an ancient Babylonian worldview is going to be very heavily tied to how they think the universe was made and the myths and stories and legends they listen to. But their idea of like what a good life looks like is going to look way different than what a 21st century American thinks a good life looks like, because we just have different values and experiences. An ancient person might place a really high emphasis on the honor of the family or clan or city that they consider themselves to be a part of or that they were born into. Whereas in modern America, we're going to usually think more about ourselves. We're going to be more individualistic. So my life is about me more than it's about my mom and dad. It's not how most people throughout history have thought. So that's just an easy example. I do want to circle back if we can, because you said that you can trace a lot of the departure from a supernatural worldview. And there's a lot of different worldviews that admit to the supernatural that are very different from one another, but just broadly from the family that is worldviews that admit to supernatural possibilities. The departure from there towards naturalism in the West. And I do want to highlight this too. It is a Western phenomena. You do not see this in the Middle East, in sub-Saharan Africa, or in the Far East, except for in areas where Westerners have a lot of influence. This is a Western, a Eurocentric movement. So we are white people that live in broadly white countries. We're probably going to think this way.
Yeah. And the West usually encompasses most of the United States and Europe.
And yeah, most of the United States is a good observation, because if you go, for example, into certain still very traditional native reservations, you know, First Nations land, they're not going to be naturalists. They're going to be what we call pantheists.
Most of North America and the United States, because I forgot about Canada. I forgot they existed, but they do. Most of the United States and Canada, but places like Mexico and in Southern or South America, they
certain parts of Africa that are very European influenced, certain parts of Southeast Asia that are very European influenced, Australia, New Zealand, places where white people from Europe exerted a lot of influence.
And so the rest,
so it is a Western movement.
Yeah.
But you said this departure, you can trace it back to Darwin. I think Darwin's a really important moment and is a really fascinating character. I want to note a few things on him, and then I want to go 200 years earlier than him, which I think is a really important step in this direction. Darwin, first of all, did not abandon his Christian faith because of his theories of evolution. He was still, at the very least, an agnostic. He was never a particularly religious individual to begin with, but he was still at least an agnostic, arguably a Christian, even after publishing his theories. And actually, some of the biggest supporters of his theories originally were evangelical Christians in the United States, which is really interesting. There was kind of a cultural and political shift, and that's why you don't see that as much in the church today. We won't dig into that right now. At any rate, Darwin ends up leaving his faith not because of his views of evolution, like formally abandoning the idea that there is a good God. He does it because his daughter dies, if I recall correctly, from tuberculosis at a fairly young age. And he can't reconcile the pain that he experienced and what he saw his daughter go through with the possibility of a good and loving God. So it was a personal experience, not his theories, that made him abandon his faith. He didn't see evolution as being mutually exclusive with the supernatural. And there's a lot of people, including us, that would say that today. These are not mutually exclusive ideas. Regardless of whether or not you believe evolution to be true, they're not mutually exclusive ideas. You can believe in both. That is allowed. You can make that make sense. Going back 200 years earlier, because I think Darwin gives the possibility for a lot of people, and this is where his idea isn't developing, especially after his death. He gives the possibility that life could have developed and changed without supernatural force being applied to it. So basically that we could start with a single-celled organism, not that he would have had this concept, but his theories are later developed as science progresses, that we could start with a single-celled organism that changes and divides and gets bigger and gets more complicated, and eventually all life could spring forward from this one common ancestor over billions and billions of years without there being a God. So he makes a world, he makes naturalism possible. But I think the desire for naturalism begins at least 200 years earlier, in earnest at least, after the 30 Years' War. If you don't know what the 30 Years' War is, here's a really quick summary. There was a lot of political wrangling between Protestants post-Protestant Reformation and Catholics, especially in Germany, but really all over Europe and all the countries that Europe was colonizing at the time in the 1600s. There was this massive war. It's called by a lot of historians the original World War, because it really was. It was fought on several different continents. It was this massive religious war between Catholics and Protestants, where Christians were just butchering each other. And when you come out the other side of it, you see this really big movement where a lot of people who lived through the horrors of this war are saying any religion that results in this kind of butchery must not be good. So rather than blame the people, they blame the religion itself. Rather than saying people are evil and bad and hurt each other, they say the religion is evil and bad and hurts people. We want to develop a society that is free from religion. Because the assumption is that if you get rid of religion, you can stop war. This is a statistically flawed assumption, because even accounting for the 30 Years' War, for various jihads for religious wars in various tribal areas for the Crusades, accounting for all that, less than 10% of deaths in war have happened in religious wars in recorded human history. Most people die in secular wars. So you don't get rid of war if you get rid of religion. You get rid of war if you get rid of people. But at any rate, people had this assumption after the 30 Years' War that if we get rid of religion, we can kind of stop large-scale violence. So now we're just looking for a way to make that work. And Darwin is one of many people who intentionally or unintentionally makes it possible for people to conceive of a world that came to exist without God making it. And he may or may not have ever really gotten there himself, but people took his ideas and ran with it.
Yeah.
So I think the 30 Years' War, we call this I've heard it called the myth of secular bedrock or secular normativity. I don't know if there's an official term for it, but it's the idea that human beings are better off if everyone is irreligious, and that the natural state of a human where they are best served is if they don't believe in a higher power, or at least are agnostic about it.
I think Natasha Crane called it the myth of secular neutrality.
Secular neutrality. Yeah. Yes. Religious I have heard that term as well.
Like that. Like you said, the 30 Year War creates this desire for this. Darwin creates the possibility of this along with some other guys who do a lot of the same stuff that he does.
Yeah. We are summarizing like 300 years of history here. So these are two big steps. There's a lot of other people you could throw in here.
Yep. And what I think ends up happening is just the way, I hate to say the secular school system did it, but like where we're at right now, what the secular school system teaches is naturalism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, math is something you can observe and prove. Science, what they actually teach as science for the most part, is something or is stuff that they are testing and proving. Language, again, you know, something that you can do correctly or do incorrectly, so you can test and prove. Even physical education and what we teach about our bodies is most of the time stuff that has been tested and proven. So there's just a lot of naturalism in secular schools. And here's where the problem is. Private schools do the same thing. And so a Christian school still has to teach all of those same things because they have to be able to say that they're meeting the same curriculum that the state requires.
Yeah.
But most of the time, they're teaching it in a way that also provides for God to be present. Or a God, because it's a private school and they may not just be a Christian school. I don't want to say that that's what causes it, but it makes it much more observable to everybody.
Yeah.
Much more prevalent for everybody.
Yeah. This is how almost any idea comes to take hold in a culture. So we could go totally off into a different field and be like, how did Central European countries become like socially liberal? And it's basically the same three things in some order, where you have a desire amongst a large number of people to believe or think a certain way. And then you have the ability to make that make sense within their own minds, to not feel like a hypocrite or not feel stupid for thinking it. Mm-hmm. And then you have a long period of time where people teach it to their kids or pay others to teach it to their kids. And after 40, 50 years, you have a whole generation of adults who are in power. They own businesses. They're politicians, they're lawyers, they're doctors, they're whatever. They have influence in their society. They're the ones in charge, and they've grown up thinking this way. That's how you change a culture. You have desire, you have ability, and then you teach it to kids. And that's not like, I'm not meaning to moralize that at all. That can be really good or really bad. It just depends on what you're teaching and what you're believing. But that's what we did. We had the desire, we were given the option, and then we taught it to our kids. Yep. That's how we became naturalists.
And so I want to give a example of this fitting into the church. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of us don't recognize it. So when you look at passages like in Ephesians 6, when you look at the armor of God and the very clear spiritual warfare that Paul describes, right? There are flaming arrows that your shield is supposed to extinguish. You're putting on armor because you're protecting yourself. When you see a world, when you see the world in a way where that is everywhere, that's kind of what Paul is describing, right? And I love the way that Paul talks about this, because when I was at the Chinese church, I met people who, everything was spiritual warfare. And I do mean everything. And I don't know that I would say everything is, but
might be a bit of an overcorrection.
Yeah. And so when Paul sees it, it's very clear that when somebody makes a decision, there are spirits. And it's, I like to picture it like the cartoons where there's, you know, a little demon and a little angel. But of course, they're completely Americanized when they're in the cartoon. But every decision that you make plays into that. Every decision that you make plays into how you follow Jesus. And so when you decide, you know, it's not that bad if I, you know, look at that picture one more time. There's two possibilities. There's the evil group, right? The evil spirit that's saying, yeah, that's fine. You already looked, so you might as well do it again. And then there's the good spirit that's telling you, no, you're trying to do better. You want that, and we can tell. So let's make that decision and decide not to, right? And
that is a very, for those listening, that is, so when we hear demons as like Western Christians, then we think of like exorcisms and stuff like that, like horror movie stuff. And that is different than real exorcisms and possession and whatnot you read about in scriptures, but valid that those things happen occasionally. But for the most part, when you read like the patristics and the Desert Fathers and stuff, and they're talking about like fighting demons, what they mean by that is literally like demons want you to sin, and they're tempting you to sin, and they're all around. But then there are these angels, these ministering spirits on behalf of God that are trying to help you not sin. And so like, what are you going to do? You know, are you going to sin or are you not going to sin? So how you fight demons, you pray, you fast, and you refuse to sin. It's not like exorcist stuff. It's a lot more boring than that.
It is. When you see the world that way, right? Paul clearly sees the world that way. The scriptures clearly tell us that that's the way that the world works. But most of us, when we make a decision, do not see that. And that's part of that ingrained naturalism. We say, well, this decision affects me and my physical body and maybe my soul if you're, you know, barely not a naturalist.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not... There's nothing going on. It's just a decision that I'm making. So I think through it logically, and that's how most people do it. And then they think through it emotionally and do whatever they want.
But... yeah, that's an episode for another day. Are we logical creatures or emotional creatures? And the answer is the latter.
But the last thing that I want to point out is the Screwtape Letters, which is a parable-ish, I guess.
Yeah, I call it a parable. I think it's a good way to describe it.
Yeah.
If you haven't read it, it's a great book.
Yeah. It's a parable that describes a demon who is tasked with attacking and weakening this Christian. But it does open your eyes to the way that a Christian worldview sees these things. Because a Christian worldview has to be supernatural if you believe the scriptures.
The book is written, for anyone that wants to check it out, Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis, and it follows the story of, or the correspondence between two demons. There's an older demon and a younger demon, and the younger demon has received his first assignment. He's assigned this young man and told basically to keep him away from Jesus. And it's a, like, C.S. Lewis uses this fictional story to kind of meditate on how people are tempted and what kinds of sins people are most likely to commit and why they commit them. But yeah, one aspect of it, and it's not really the point that C.S. Lewis is making, but one aspect that's fun to meditate on is like you know, there is an unseen world, a spiritual world that affects how we behave. And we don't think about it. So if you want to know if you're secretly a naturalist or at least kind of act like one, ask yourself the question, when's the last time I was making a decision and I thought, is this demonic? Is this something that God wants from me? How would Jesus feel? How does Jesus feel? Something along those lines. When's the last time you were making a decision and you thought that? You literally thought, like, what effect, what spiritual effect does this have on the world? If you didn't think some question along that those lines in the last like 6 months, you're a naturalist. And like, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably believe in Jesus. But what we're trying to point out to you is like, your behavior may not be 100% aligned with what you believe. And the best way to fix that is, first of all, it's like going to rehab. The first step is to admit there's a problem. And then you can attack it. And the ways that you attack it is by praying more often, by reading the Bible more often, going to small groups, surrounding yourself with Christians that will call you out and make you think this way. And hopefully listening to podcasts like this help too.
That's only 5 steps. We need 6 more to make it a 12-step program like rehab.
So I didn't realize that 5 + 6 = 12, Martin.
Because you added 5 to the first one, which was to recognize you have a problem. So there's 6 total.
Okay, I see what you're doing there.
Yeah.
What I heard you say was, that's 5 steps. We need 6 more to get to 12. And I was like, that broke them. That math ain't mathing.
The first step and then 5 more is the next
section. Moving on. Moving on. Martin, I want us to make sure that we have enough time to talk through our arguments in favor of a spiritual worldview. So I think let's make that a separate episode. So are there any parting thoughts or any other things that you want to cover as far as what naturalism is, what it looks like in a Christian life, or how it became the default way of thinking in the West? Is there anything that we've missed that you want to revisit?
I think that there's a lot of things that play into this, right? And one of the things that I think makes naturalism appealing is naturalism lets me live a fast-paced and pretty focused life. So when I say that, I mean I don't have to care for my soul. And so one of the things that gets really dangerous with naturalism is you can be serving in the church and never realize that you're exhausted, because that has never occurred to you. Taking care of your soul has never occurred to you. It's just there. I think that ends up playing into this worldview is, I can take care of my body. I can eat well and exercise. But how am I taking care of my soul? Well, if I don't think it needs taken care of, then I'm not doing anything for it. And like you said, it's partially in our actions. Am I intentionally taking time to be in scripture? Am I intentionally taking time to pray? Am I intentionally taking time to practice my spiritual disciplines so that I can rest my soul and let it align with Jesus better?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kind of taking what Martin said and just going a little bit broader, one of the things that's so appealing about naturalism is it makes life simpler. It doesn't make life simple. Life is always complicated, but it makes life more simple because it takes what Christians would say is, I don't know if saying half of reality is the right way to put it, but it takes this huge chunk of reality. If reality is both physical and spiritual, it takes this huge chunk of the world and just says, yeah, just don't worry about that, bro. Just like, you know, like when you're cleaning up when you're a kid and your parents tell you to clean up when you get home from work or from school before they get home from work. And then you like sit down and play video games instead. And then you hear your mom's car pull in and you're like, oh no, I still do this as an adult when my wife asks me to do things sometimes.
I definitely do the same thing.
But you're just like, oh no. And then you just start like pushing clothes under the bed and like throwing things in the closet and close the doors and you just hope mom doesn't notice. Like, that's kind of what naturalism does with the spiritual. it's just like, no, man, you just don't need to worry about it. Just ignore it. Just throw it in the closet and close the door and pretend it doesn't exist. And of course, that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. If you put a bunch of dirty laundry in your closet, you're still going to smell it. So you can ignore the spiritual aspects of your life and pretend they don't exist. They're still going to affect you.
Especially if it's your favorite t-shirt and you haven't washed it yet.
Sounds like experience.
It might
be. So naturalism is, at its core, its appeal is that it's lazy. That it gives you permission to not reckon with things that you need to reckon with. And I think that's what makes it continually appealing, besides just the fact that for most of us, we were taught this from a young age. So avoid it. If you're thinking like a naturalist and not reckoning with spiritual realities, fix it. And fix it by being in Christian community, by prayer, by reading the scriptures, by reading the church fathers, by listening to good teaching. Like, you need to fix it, because it'll be hard. It will require work. But it will help you to align yourself with the way that God designed you to live. And it will ultimately make your life better. It's not going to make you richer or give you a nicer house, but it is going to help you live more at peace. It's going to help you live more satisfied. It's going to help you live closer to God and others. So it is worth the work. We're going to cut off on that note, I think. Our next episode is going to be about why we think thinking spiritually makes sense, why it's justifiable, why it's not stupid to believe in gods and angels and demons, etc. So we're going to cover that a little bit in our next episode. Thank you guys so much for joining us. We hope that some of this was thought-provoking and helpful to you, and helped you to recognize areas of your life where maybe you need a change, or helped you recognize some disciplines that you need to bring into practice in your life, things that will draw you closer to Jesus.
And we hope that you have a cowabunga day.
We'll see you back here next time on Pocket Theology.